This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by sponsors Best Fiends and Feels. Advertisers like these keep The Bladder Presents going, so please keep an ear out for those ad spots and the promo codes later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
While driving around on the Mendocino Coast, they both decided that this was going to be the end. That based on talking with all their friends and witnesses, that if they can't have their kids, that nobody was going to have those kids.
The teachers knew, the neighbors knew, and now the children are dead.
Hey, Nancy Grace, don't help. A new hour-long documentary confronts the deaths of Jen and Sarah Hart and their six adopted children in A Thread of Deceit, the Hart Family Tragedy. But did this documentary need to exist? And does it do anything the Broken Hearts podcast didn't? Later, we'll talk about a docu-nactment hybrid, American Animals, from the director of The Imposter, and about whether this genre buster fails like the rare book heist it's about. No free hugs here, folks. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 139. I feel like that intro might have been missing a verb somewhere, but you know what? It's pandemic time and we all have to do without. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime worth your time. My guest always makes sure to stuff a first edition in his backpack on the way out the door. It is Jeb Lund. Hello again, Jeb.
Thank you for having me. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I am free to do this for what looks now to be the rest of my life. So
that's actually really wonderful to hear. I'm so glad to hear that. I'm also really looking forward to hearing what you think of our most wanted topic. Which is the awkwardly titled A Thread of Deceit, colon, The Hart Family Tragedy. This is available on Amazon Prime to buy and also on various other on-demand services, I think. There will be some links in the show notes. Here's the case file from the IMDb. Quote, an SUV with a female couple and their six adopted children plunge into the Pacific Ocean. Sick. Leaving behind more questions than answers. This is, of course, Jen and Sarah Hart. This was the subject of the Broken Hearts podcast last year. Now we have a 57-minute documentary in which one, not expert, but talking head interviewee is captioned as online gaming friend. That'll be in the visual aids. I'm not quite sure where to start with this, which is actually kind of the problem in my view with this documentary. So let me start by asking you, Jeb, how much you knew about this case before you watched this?
Well, as it turned out, I knew the boy Devante from the viral photo of him from the Ferguson protests, but I knew nothing else about this. And that is, I think, kind of tonally what threw me. It is almost framed like you know who all these people are and you know what this tragedy must be. So there's no real effort except from like sinister scattered quotations at the beginning to explain what you're about to see. Yeah. And that presumption of knowledge on something that like evidently was like this ephemeral kind of, I think, does a disservice to the viewer and also, I guess, to, you know, the people in this.
Well, I'm actually glad to hear. Well, first of all, I apologize for not warning you what you were about to get into. And listeners, if it's not too late, content warning, we are talking about the deaths of children. I'm interested to hear how you felt about it from the perspective of someone who didn't know about this case, who I assume you had not listened to the Broken Hearts podcast. I did listen to that, and I don't think this... It's almost like this is a follow-on to that podcast in that it does assume this knowledge, but then the central problem with this documentary, which again is under an hour long, and as much as I enjoy an efficient production, this is not efficient. This is just disorganized and elliptical, I think. How did you end up sort of getting a sense of the case? Were you like Googling while you were watching it? Did the documentary tell you what was going on?
I let the documentary speak to me because I didn't want to cheat and Google and then be comparing it against my expectations. Right. But once I did afterward, what was interesting to me, or I guess frustrating to me, is that there isn't a lot to leave out from this story. They get most of it. So it makes the stuff that they do leave out seem perplexing, because it actually does underline or, you know, emphasize certain aspects of this that, you know, you might feel a little bit ambiguous about, like how monstrous is the mother, Jen? Well, like just reading Wikipedia, you know, just the simple Wikipedia entry, you get a quote from the first time that they get CPS called on them. And you know, it's a quote from her where she says, she's playing the food card, just give her water, referring to one of the kids being upset that she is being basically starved as punishment. Like right. That, she's playing the food card, is such a money quote. It seems like a disservice to the victims of this to leave that out. Similarly, in Washington, where you have the DeKalb neighbors who are worried that Jen and Sarah are abusing their children, we basically have, like, from the friends and from the DeKalbs, a kind of he said, she said of what you should expect. And then they leave out the anecdote, I guess, of Jen explaining that the kids were telling them that they were being abused because they're drug babies and their biological mother was bipolar. So it carries with it this sort of like delegitimizing the victim that you would have in a rape case. Oh, she's crazy, right?
Right.
She doesn't know what she's talking about. And it just seems so fundamentally vile that to leave it out, like, you know, just seems, again, like malpractice, right? Like there is an ambiguity here, and there isn't a he said, she said here. But at the end, we still have this sort of like meditation on dueling recriminations in a public space, which that's a different documentary. I don't really need to know about like why online can be vicious to people. But like the idea that there can be a reasonable misunderstanding here, I think is very belied by she's playing the food card. They're drug babies. They're bipolar. They lie.
Well, and that the other aspect of the extreme online-ness of the story is that Jen is spending the bulk of her time and making the bulk of her social contacts in a like RPG online first person shooter game, which you're shown. But then that part of it is not commented on. Like, I'm not a sociologist. I was a lit major. I'm not qualified. But it seems like the documentary is extremely concerned with the difference between appearance and reality, to the point where after like 30 minutes of this, you feel like the actual realities are being pointedly avoided.
Yes.
As topics. I mean, all right, let's start with the fact that much of the story of this family takes place at the kind of festivals that I felt hives forming even hearing about them. That's Buncee. That's not the festivals, but okay. In our first clip in this section, a friend who has like that hairstyle is talking about the experience of, I think it's Devante who like hugs someone who's doing some kind of like drum performance, mm-hmm. and then hugs his mom, and was this sincere?
And with his sobbing face, he ran straight into Jen's arms. And when I saw that, I just started bawling. Because what I saw so clearly there was that he loved her and she loved him. What I saw there, and again, I'm looking through my confirmation bias, I saw pure love.
Well, my bias against these festivals notwithstanding, my confirmation bias is that this is straight out of the, you know, today my six-year-old said this profundity at carpool, made up tweet land. And this Instagram-ly packaging seems extremely obvious to me, but I've been running websites since I had to do it on, you know, lightning fast 56K dial-up. So maybe some people aren't as cynical, but that the documentary keeps returning to this, it is like, like, not everyone is as happy as they seem on Facebook and the gram. I think we all got that in, like, I don't know, 2012?
Right.
Right? Well,
the other thing about that crying, right, is they present, you know, he weeps when he hugs people. But you learn that before you learn how the kids have been abused. And then that doesn't get interrogated afterward, after you know the sort of hidden story. So we don't have the mechanisms or the data to dispute this woman's confirmation bias. But also, like, that just seems like a huge missed opportunity for exploration, right? Because we only know two things about this kid, really. Like, he's an abused child, one, and he can't hug people without weeping. And the most iconic moment of that.
What he likes to do on his birthday is to give people free hugs to raise money. Like, there is not a 14-year-old boy on earth who actually wants to do that.
Right.
I'm sorry. Like, I was not a 14-year-old boy. Would you like to testify as to the believability of that statement?
Oh, no. I mean, like, you want to see, like, breasts or get, like, a Sega Genesis when you're 14, I guess. But, like, the thing to me, though, is, like, the most iconic image we have of this kid is him hugging a cop.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you don't normally associate with, like, black kids finding refuge and safety in a cop's arms. And that seems to be a really kind of, like, provocative thing to interrogate about this, because we know he's abused. So maybe we can re-examine the context in which he's weeping being held by a cop. Now, maybe that's Jen manipulating him into getting another grammable moment. Or maybe it's that, like, he can't stop crying because every time he hugs another person who's not his mother, he has a vision or an experience of what it must be like to be held by somebody who's not a psychopath.
Right. Or, like, this is what it must be like to be, you know, this is a parental figure who would give me 3 squares a day.
Right.
Like, where exactly are the tears coming from? And this documentary gives you no context as to the kids, like, developmental challenges, should they have existed, as to, the entire focus is, like, you know, social media distorts everything, which after a certain point, it's like, yeah, it does. But if you're going to have to talk about what exactly was getting distorted eventually, and the clip that we're about to hear makes a good point about that the sort of receivers of a social media signal don't necessarily go back to verify what's happening, that we just sort of blow past it and are like, you know, like, next thing. But this is the issue with this documentary overall, is that this aspect of this case alone is probably a 90-minute or 110-minute documentary. Mm-hmm. The abuse is a feature-length documentary. The system that privileged these two white ladies over the family of origin of color and let the kids be taken out of state, kind of on a rubber stamp, that's a 3-part series. Like, it just feels to me like this documentary is like, we have something to say about how you can't believe everything you see on Instagram. And then they were just really afraid to scratch any other surface besides that one. Anyway, here is clip 3.
I think this is an example of how that extremist and rapid environment of sharing information blows over and doesn't look back to check back in on parts of the story that don't maybe necessarily fit a narrative that could go viral, that are more complex, more nuanced, and, like, that's where our humanity is. the deepest truths about us are not totally black and white. There's a gradient. All the shade exists there. And like, that is so important to be able to have a venue for discussing that. And the mainstream media and social media are moving at such a pace that we don't even discuss in a context where our humanity can be understood.
I mean, this is someone who doesn't own a television. I will bet you money, so grain of salt. But it's not that he's saying anything that is untrue or like not worth thinking about. It's that there are, you know, half a dozen axes along which this story operates that are troubling and or criminal. And this documentary can't get off the one. I wouldn't say.
Yeah. And I don't, I mean, from a journalism standpoint, I know I've done sort of featurey articles where you get a couple core interviews and then you really don't get anything from people, but they say something really good.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, yeah. Shit, I gotta use this because I don't really have anything good from this person. And I got to justify the fact that they flew me to Las Vegas or whatever. and it kind of feels like they're using the best that they have from these people, which is again, flabbergasting because of the details that they leave out. Like you brought up the fact that the state of Texas privileges this white couple over the people of color who are actually, you know, created these children. And like one of the things on Wikipedia I saw was 50% of their family income was straight from the state of Texas.
Yeah.
Because they're getting, I guess, like, you know, here's your wellness money, go feed them. That's also a provocative thing we could have talked about rather than just kind of like hitting the Rashomon button of social media.
It's clear fairly early in the documentary that like nobody who is being interviewed is being interviewed because they noticed something. It's because they didn't. So how many ways, I mean, with the exception of the neighbor, and we'll get to a quote from her, but it's like, and you know, they did the right thing. They like called the authorities and were like, look, this kid came over and asked for like a Costco pack of tortillas. Some shit is happening next door. But the documentary lets that testimony speak for itself and then isn't, it's like it's loath to wade into like some kind of controversy involving like race or privilege or I don't know. I think that this is one of those stories where it's not possible to like really slice off one part of it or zoom in really tight on one part of it. It's all of it together. And this like Thread of Deceit is not up to it.
No.
Also, that title is way too long. Like the Hart family tragedy, you're done. Where did the threads come in?
A lot of this documentary just seems weirdly mismanaged. There's a bit that Bill Simmons, a sports writer for the audience, I know you know who Bill Simmons is, right? But like, you know, he used to have a bit where he said, I wish I could have like, I don't know if he phrased it this way, like a common sense coordinator, like somebody who would just blow a whistle and say like, you don't waste a time out here. You know,
right.
This is how you do clock management. And I wish there had been somebody like that on this documentary who'd be like, just hang on a second. Because there's so many weird little details. Like one, like almost everybody in this documentary is filmed with a musical instrument in the background.
Yeah.
Like, and they're people that are not like from the festivals. Like the forensic psychologist has a cello in the background. Right. Like,
oh yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. The white guy who looks like he shaves in the dark has a cello in the background. Christopher Worth, one of the friends who has like some evocative things to say about, you know, not wanting to question, a lesbian couple. Like he has a keyboard and Fender amps, Zipper Lomax has a guitar, Amanda and Jennifer Price have a guitar and ukulele, Don Corey has a bass. And you're just like, what? I mean, I was expecting there to be something like they all met at a jam session at a drum circle at one of these that was going to kind of bring it home because you also see the kids with musical instruments and you're like, where does this knit together?
Yeah.
But then like the other thing that drove me crazy and like, I mean, I watch Hallmark movies. I'm used to relentless piano trilling in the background, never giving you a chance to like experience an emotion on your own terms, but like the first
right,
like 9.5 minutes of this movie, and then like a large portion of it afterward, are like, it sounds like the this sample create your own movie material when you launch iMovie. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what happens when you're going to create my first project. Mm-hmm. It's just this kind of like placeholder music through it that's kind of trill. I mean, it sort of, you expect like, well, here's the montage of happiness, but of course it's taking you down a lane of foreboding, and you're like, just change the tone, just pick a different key.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of used to discounting the, like, the same cactus and cloud formation going by in the background in terms of where people are being filmed, because it's like, all right, this is an indie documentary, they got a B&B for a weekend, and
yeah,
they brought their own instruments, and that's what's happening. And I have to go back and reread between the lines. When I got the PR blast for this documentary, there is attached to the email an interview with the producer, Rachel Morgan. It's still not entirely clear who ended up directing this thing, and Morgan refers obliquely to many changes in the production team as this documentary was being made, which is like, okay, but all of this only even happened 2 years ago. So I don't know. Like, so I would really love to just sit her down with a bottle of Tito's and be like, okay, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You had another short clip that you called for. Would you like to talk about that, or shall we hear it first?
Yeah, let's just go ahead and play it.
Okay.
Someone taking something so beautiful and running it with it and creating so much hate and diversity.
Just do another take, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to compromise the truthfulness of this documentary because this lady misspoke. But I was like, what? Because I thought maybe there was a point that was coming or that I missed. And
yeah.
I just went back and it's like, just do another take. And it's not as if, you know, the other things that she says in that clip are so emotionally devastating. We're not dealing with this little bit of flubbed line because that's the price we have to pay for this 30 seconds of absolutely riveting soul bearing. It's pretty much like, well, I didn't know, like the rest of the people who didn't know, but who insist on still bearing some respect for Jen and Sarah.
And well, this is another aspect of the story that the documentary seems organizationally unprepared to get into, which is that Jen had, whether it was, you know, paranoia or that she was anxious because she was getting so much hate online. And there's a quote from someone talking about how, you know, she acted as though she did not want a public persona, but she spent a lot of time crafting one for her family as an entity. That, again, the Hart family tragedy seems just unprepared generally to confront, like, what was the role of the online community's interrogation or rejection of Jen and of the family, or of her version of their family narrative? No, well, I don't have an answer. I just think that if you're going to get into this story, like, you're going to have to deal with all of it. Like, it's a big, heavy octopus, this one. It's bleak, and you don't actually get to pick which parts of it you're going to fight. That was a terrible metaphor. Help me.
No, it's fine. I think one of the missed opportunities is, you know, you're talking about, why does Jen curate this perfect family but also retreat from actually engaging with the real world? And that, to me, is like every hallmark of somebody who is very traumatized as a kid in some way. And so the superimposition of this, you know, like, impermeable order on her life, like, seems like the kind of, you know, classic overreaction to not having some sort of control before, but we don't know what that could be. And I presume that there are other people from her life and her childhood who are around, where maybe we could see if there was some genesis to this that makes her seem like less of a self-created monster.
Right.
I mean, as long, if you're insisting on you know, like the DeKalb family and like the police record of this seems fairly indisputable. But if you're going to create a, well, here are multiple perspectives structure on this, you could be doing it also for their, for lack of a better term, origin story, rather than just sort of doing it at the end.
The documentary drops you in like a year or 2 years before the fateful day. So again, that is a choice. And then to sort of later on allude to problems in Oregon and to have this talking head interview with the stepbrother, half brother in Texas, like here again,
why
you need to ask him to put on a shirt, like
exactly.
Come on.
I have no idea what he contributed to that other than to, like, I think the idea might have been to humanize these children, but you generally don't need to go very far to humanize and emphasize the tragedy of murdering children. So, like, I know that people loved them besides Jen and Sarah. I don't know how this guy expressed that in a way that, like, you know, the average viewer couldn't just kind of into it. You know, that like children would be loved by people who had met them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, you know, one of many ways in which this documentary seems to think that it's like a documentary is a second language. And it's like this is what I am. I mean, right, though, that's like I am mirroring this thing that I see documentaries do, which is to have this interview with this pertinent figure, but it's just slightly off. It's like Lloyd's dad in Better Off Dead being like, Lloyd, mellow off, and like consulting his book. Like, that's not, you have no ear for this. Like, are you going to tell the part of the story where the kid's Texas family wanted them and weren't allowed to keep them or not? Yeah. I mean, there's just so much that this documentary doesn't do. We have yet more thoughts on this, but first, a word from our sponsor, Feels. What is Feels? Feels with an A is premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. If you're experiencing stress or anxiety, if who amongst us is not at this historic moment, or you're suffering from chronic pain or sleeplessness, you're not alone. Many, if not most of us do, certainly lately. I'm an anxious person at the best of times. These times are not that. While I'm certainly grateful to have lots to do, it's been predictably tougher to focus of late. I was looking for something that would help, and then I found Feels. Feels naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. My anxious road usually begins in the form of spinning about my long to-do list and then spinning about spinning. Feels helps me calm down, focus, break the cycle, and get on with things. And it's really easy to take, too. Place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and feel the difference in minutes. The thing about CBD is that finding the right dose is key, and everyone's is different, so you'll want to leave room to experiment over the course of a week or so, and you'll also want to take advantage of Feels' free CBD hotline, where a real human can help guide your experience. Whatever dose you settle on, Feels is going to work naturally. There's no high, hangover, or addiction. Join the Feels community to get Feels delivered to your door every month. You'll save money that way, and you can pause or cancel anytime. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/blotter, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/blotter, 2 T's, to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/blotter. Thank you, Feels. Thank you for holding. Back to the Hart family tragedy. In our next clip, once again, we are preoccupied with the idea of Facebook versus reality. But this is the psychologist and then the neighbor talking. And this, I thought, was a pretty good juxtaposition of interviewees, albeit once again seeming like somewhat documentary via Starman. Here's clip five.
One of the impressions I got when you sent me the photos, of the Facebook feeds of Jen and Sarah is like how perfect they are, right? And the word perfectly curated comes up a lot. And you know what that implies is curation implies an active image manipulation, essentially. So there were, they live the kinds of lives that they can project this perfect image of themselves because most of their quote unquote friends were either through Facebook or there are kind of these temporary encounters at festivals where they could, on a temporary basis, project everything positive they wanted to project about them.
The pictures of them playing in the snow. Those kids were not outside playing in the snow, but yet there's this picture of them, you know, and it's so perfectly propped with Devante and I think it was Jeremiah, and they're sitting out in the snow and they have a mug in their hand and they're probably, you know, drinking hot chocolate, or where they're on the side of a lake and they are turning around and blowing kisses to mom.
I mean, here again, more questions than answers. The issue with this case, of course, is that the answer that we really want is never coming. But there are certain broader questions that investigation of this case could bring forward that this sometimes is on the point of doing. For instance, specifically here, like if these photos weren't taken in the snow outside of the home where this neighbor could witness it, like where were they? Like were there forced photo shoot hikes? What right. do we actually know? Because if we really know as little as this documentary seems to think we do, then there's almost no basis to make a documentary.
Yeah, well, two things about that. One kind of on your point and one kind of at cross purposes to the documentary. In, I can't remember what it was, maybe it was an E! Article I read about this. There's an observation that one of these lovable group family photos, it is about them painting a wall in mm-hmm. the house, but all the kids' paintbrushes are mm-hmm. dry. And if we have that, that seems like a very visually evocative shorthand thing to show. And I wonder why they didn't show it. Is it that they couldn't get somebody to comment on it on screen and they didn't want to do an omniscient narrator thing or point to it? I don't know. But that seems to underline without the problems of like where was the photo actually taken. But the other thing, the second one that I think kind of is at cross purposes to the documentary is goes back to the first clip or the first speaker, which is the forensic psychologist Octavio Choi. And he says... the words carefully curated come up a lot. Well, where? I'm pretty sure they didn't come up on the Facebook feed that they sent him photos of.
Yeah.
So where did they come up a lot? Why is he making that observation? Who provoked the observation? Why does he need to be sent the photos? If he's a forensic psychologist, doesn't he have access to the file? Which makes me wonder, because his comments are so glib. And he seems to be responding to the provocations of the documentarians, at least with the carefully curated thing. It seems to be something he was told by them, or I don't know, was he looking at footage? Either way, I get the impression that he got this file the night before. He doesn't seem particularly versed in
yeah.
this case.
No, I just assumed that this was some guy that some friend of the production knew. And was he captioned as a forensic psychologist or just a psychologist?
I think forensic okay. psychologist. I mean, I'm not the end, but I mean,
you know, I'm not saying that he wasn't, but again, like I have also been in the position of reporting a story, and like you go into one of those online databases of counselors and psychologists who make themselves available for documentaries and stories and relationship listicles, and this is the kind of analysis that 90% of the time with that you get, that they have kind of a rehearsed thing that they would say. I just assumed that Choi was just one of those, you know, not expert for hire, but you know what I'm saying. It's like how you see like any mafia thing on TV. It's like, what is the over under on when Selwyn Robb shows up? You had another do another clip. Like, I was going to play a clip like, oh, here's the neighbor talking about when it became clear that, you know, they were being starved. But it's like, well, this story is so much broader and deeper in any number of directions than this documentary is letting it be, that I almost don't see the point in continuing to batter it.
No, it's starting to feel mean. I had a couple of quick hits, if you want, on the way out. One is that my beloved first cousin Cassidy lives in Mendocino and Fort Bragg, so I recognized the part of the coast where they went off, and it was like this really inappropriate moment of like, oh, I know there. And of course, like, if you've seen, you know, the intro to Murder, She Wrote, you also know there, because that's where the intro was filmed. I had one last clip, which was kind of my final take on this, if you want to play it.
FML means fuck my life.
Yep, sure does.
That's actually a very good clip to pull, because first of all, you have that like sweetened synth sustain in the background that's like, okay, if you don't already feel sad, we're gonna come over there and pull a nose hair just to make sure you get it. And second of all, that this documentary that cannot seem to get untangled from this sole topic of extreme onlineness and its mortal perils thinks it has to explain fuck my life.
Yep, that's the part that you clarified for us. The rest, not so much.
I did have one more clip that I will play, and then I will do one last drive-by on this thing, and then we'll move on.
I can't imagine, like, getting to the point where, I mean, if you want to kill yourself, that's one thing, but I don't see why you would need to take anyone else with you.
Well, you, a civilian, might not see that, but if nobody working on this documentary, most particularly a forensic psychologist, is familiar with or going to cite the family annihilator model of these mass murder / murder suicides, I don't think you need to be stepping to this case at all. Like, Google John List and then just stop. Just stop.
Or you could really have just watched one episode each of Law & Order Classic, Law & Order SVU, and Law & Order CI, because remember, every one of those has had a standout family annihilator episode. It's not an obscure concept in the zeitgeist of true crime or just crime story.
Or life. Like, it's a hideous thing to contemplate, but if you really aren't familiar with it / can't face it, then you don't have to make a documentary about it. There is an article that I'll link in the show notes from this site called Bellow Collective, which the author was talking about, actually the Broken Hearts podcast, of which he was not a huge fan, but said something to the effect of, it's really difficult to sort of get 3/4 of the way into your story and realize that you're in over your head. And she felt like that's what happened on the podcast, and they probably should have just folded the tents. And I would really have loved to hear what this reviewer thought of this documentary, because it was over its head immediately and absolutely should have folded the tents. Like, you know, again, it's called A Thread of Deceit, The Hart Family Tragedy. It is on video on demand. Don't demand it. All right, let's move on, if we may, to the cold case section. We are talking about American Animals, which came out a couple years ago and is available on HBO Go and or rentable in the usual places. Here is the case file. In late 2004, 4 students at Lexington, Kentucky's Transylvania University tried to pull a heist on the Transy Library's rare books collection, thinking they could sell valuable first editions at a New York City auction house. very little went according to plan, and this retired book search coordinator could have told them those Audubons are fucking heavy. And all four perps ended up in the federal pen, and then ended up in Bart Layton's 2018 docudrama American Animals as themselves. I consider Layton's The Imposter a classic in the genre. I revere Soderbergh's Ocean's 11. Does that mean American Animals' mashup of standard talking head interviews and jazzy heist sequences featuring actors worked for me or really didn't? I really liked it. I'm not sure that's going to be a common opinion. I feel like I heard not that much about this when it came out. Had you seen this before? What'd you think of it?
I had never heard a word about this, and I think this is extraordinary. I think this is just a wonderful movie.
I'm so glad. I really, a reader of the Best Evidence newsletter was like, really fired up at how much she hated it. And I was like, oh, like, what did I miss? I mean, could just be a taste issue, but had you seen The Imposter?
I don't believe so. No, like I felt, I think I Googled it and read the summary and was like, I should know that, but I don't. I think in my head, I was confusing it with The Informant.
Yes.
The Soderbergh movie.
Sure.
And yeah, I think that was it. So I came in really blind, which is one of the things I do enjoy about this podcast, where it's like, oh, something I would not have encountered that turns out to be like really engrossing. And this was one of those happy accidents where like I just had no idea what I was in for. I did know from the description that you gave me, and I was like, oh, that seems like that could just be just an absolute travesty of a piece of media. And I wound up being like the most evocative version of both.
Yeah, it had all of these things that I kind of love. Like, it has, you know, Audubon prints of birds. I like those. It has, like, old bookiana. I like that. It has, like, Ocean's 11 and Diner and Reservoir Dogs references. I love all those things.
It's funny.
Yeah, it's funny. There's some interesting visual renditions of things. And I really like this idea, which makes absolute perfect sense, that in a documentary, you don't just get any old person to reenact it and then you just shoot them out of focus because they're probably not great. You just drive it straight down the middle of the fairway and you have like name actors doing a scripted version of what the actual people are telling you. Like, why aren't they all like this? I thought this was great. Maybe this is lightning in a bottle, though. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it would be really difficult. I mean, I feel bad for anybody who ever wants to do this again, because everybody's going to say, like, well, you're just doing American Animals. But you should. I mean, like, just because somebody just hits it right out of the park the first time doesn't mean you can't, you know, use it as a, you know, use their approach as an instrument for a completely different story. I mean, obviously it can't be wholly original, but like, you know, I think the only reason why people maybe hadn't done it before is worrying about undermining the concept of the documentary as a factual document. But all right. Reenactments do that. All reenactments have a presumption of understanding of what transpired where we don't have an accurate record. There's always some part of the recreation that fills in a blank spot for the police or a blank spot in testimony. And at least this way it owns it. And then it makes it way more evocative, like both as a true thing and as a, like, I don't know how else to explain this except, what's her name? The librarian, the actress who's the
handmaid.
Ann Dowd, right. Like, there is an emotional distancing I experience when I see Ann Dowd writhing on the floor and saying, please don't hurt me, because Ann Dowd does that sort of thing because that's her job. But then when you finally see the librarian who did that, like, you hear Ann Dowd in your head as this librarian is talking to you in the point past her trauma. And I don't know how that worked for you, but for me, it was like this automatic emotional recapitulation to that moment of her wailing in like terror and despair, and knowing that this woman that I've seen made a noise like that. You know, that that woman that I'm seeing at the end of it was on a floor at one point thinking she was going to die.
Well, but also you have everything else that Anne Dowd has ever done. So
yeah.
There's the fact that she is playing a victim of this crime whose name is BJ Gooch. So
yeah.
Look, I don't want to be five, but we all have our roles to play in life's rich pageant, minus that it's of a kindergartner.
You got to do it.
Thank you. And then you have Anne Dowd, the Aunt Lydia in Handmaid's Tale, and you have Anne Dowd from The Leftovers, and you have Anne Dowd from, I can't remember the name of it, but it's like this famous like Milgram experiment case. Listeners, at me on Twitter, at Blotter Presents. I just cited this the other day, and I can't pull the name right now. It's something very broad that I'll be like, oh, of course. Anyway, there's all of the Anne Dowd baggage in the culture. But then at the same time, when you ask someone of Anne Dowd's like acting magnitude to take this on, I don't know how to put this exactly, but like the idea that a documentary is an objective document is exploded, but I think in the best possible way. That like there are many choices that documentarians make that we don't think about or choose not to be conscious of, but when you set up your story this way, the choices are also part of the narrative for the viewer. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but I liked it because I thought it was cool to watch Layton's process in this way.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point, and it's one of those things that people don't really consider. Like, you know, we look at newspapers as being a factual and mostly objective document, but the choice that the photo editor makes of, do they show Clinton smiling or do they show Bill Clinton doing that thing where he bites his lower lip?
Right.
And so is that the regretful Bill Clinton's caught in a lie face or what? And the choice to use that freights whatever the article is with, you know, our collective impressions of Bill Clinton going like, well, you know, and so you're making that choice here, but it's overt. And so I think that allows a viewer who maybe isn't an aggressive questioner of how historiography is created or how stories are mediated to become alert to the process. So they know that they're being worked on. And maybe they take that to another documentary, which I consider to be like a social service that this movie does. But at least by making it overt, then you start to, like, as a viewer, I think, engage more and more intellectually with it. Like, because the movie's going to do, it's going to work emotionally for you if you're just following the story and you're not alienated by it, but actually kind of asking how these stories get put together, I think adds a really wonderful layer to it.
Yeah. Especially since, like, once I knew that this was the guy behind the imposter, I was like, okay, this makes a lot more sense. But he also lets himself be charmed by the robbers, and in particular Warren Lipka. In our first clip, here's Warren being like saying to God, why can't I remember his name? Stuart? Eric? It's not Eric. It's not
Spencer.
Chaz. Spencer. Saying to Spencer, like, so you want to hang out? And Spencer's like, nah. And he's like, well, I'm coming over. And then this is what they're up to. This is the topic of discussion while they are, or Warren is graffitiing something. Clip 9.
You want to do something? I think I'm going to go to bed.
I'm coming over.
Seriously, man? Fuck fraternities. The reason to be a part of that is so one day you can walk in the door of an office you never want to go in to see a guy you never want to meet, all in the hopes that he might give you a job you never want to fucking do.
Something I've often thought about is how my life would have been different if I hadn't met Warren.
So this is the dinosaur T-Rex trying to turn off a ceiling fan.
I mean,
fucking amazing.
There's Evan Peters as Warren, and then there's actual Warren, who's like, eh? And I paused it at that point and was like, that tattoo is fucking amazing. I just like started laughing, and it was like, look, you kind of have to buy in with these people.
Oh, the actual Warren, it takes, I think, a half a second for him to just completely own the frame. Just one of the most like stunningly naturally charismatic people I've seen. Like, I was won over the instant I saw him. I was like, I understand now why these people did this, because he said so.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe Evan Peters like didn't have like maybe as much presence to pull off. I think maybe that might be the only shortcoming of the movie, but it's a really difficult role to nail, and I would need to see it again to give a fair shot. But like, also I think anybody trying to compare themselves to the real Warren is just going to have like the hardest task.
I thought he did a pretty good job. I was like, there are moments when he seems, it felt like the actual Warren would have been a little like cooler under pressure. But at the same time, I think you're absolutely right that like it's going to be really hard to cast that guy. Like the closer, it'll be like the uncanny Warren. Like it just won't be quite right. And Evan Peters, I think, was like, well, I'm going to set it up over here and do it like this.
I think also like acting wise, I think there's a tendency like you want to bake in some vulnerability and doubt, because dimensionally that gives you more to play with as an actor. And I think probably the way that Warren actually worked in real life is like the Wile E. Coyote principle. Like you just have to keep walking and never look down.
Yeah, and for sure.
And like as an actor, you don't want to do that because it's one note. Like being bluff and overconfident or just like steamrolling other people doesn't give you as much to play with. And like maybe he should have been reined in a little bit more. Like, no, less depth. You don't need as much.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's also possible that like after years and years of doing various very outre moments in American Horror Story, that he was like, this is reined in, y'all. Like,
oh, yeah.
Am I wearing latex from brows to toes? No, then, this is nuance. This is very interior. I did think he was good. I did think that the script did a good job. Bart Layton also wrote it. I think the script did a good job weaving the two, like going back and forth between the two sides. I didn't feel like the integration was kludgy, and I felt that Spencer did a good job explaining like, well, this was just, it started out as like, we're gonna smoke pot and like, what if we rob the thing? And then this is why I didn't stop it when it got too real. Clip 10.
Well, you got a better idea, Spence? No.
Fuck!
I was torn between the desire to keep the adventure going and waiting for the insurmountable obstacle that would stop everything in its tracks and return things to normal.
Yeah, I just thought that was such a good line. And yeah, that observation, which it's entirely possible that like they had a bunch of takes, or this was pulled from the original Vanity Fair article, which all of them participated in except Chaz, while they were still in the joint from like 13 years ago. We'll link it in the show notes. Like, I don't know how that snippet was arrived at by the company, but this is like, if you compare that to, you know, so much hate and diversity from the Most Wanted section, that it's like, you know what? Like you said, it's okay to have a plan for a spontaneous utterance. And he did. And like, I don't know, like this movie looks cool. The main players are allowed to have insights, but it doesn't sound too canned or like tabloid news mag-y. I think it's just really great. I wish that Bart Layton would remake like 15 documentaries about various things, because I just think it's a really cool way to do it. And I am not accustomed to laughing while preparing for this podcast. This was fun.
Yeah. And not to, you know, again, compare this unfavorably to the thing we panned in the first part of this episode, but like when you talk about wanting to hit the Rashomon button, that does, this does that in a way that is not obnoxious. And sometimes, like you said, it's very funny. Like, there are bits where you have Spencer and Warren going back to back, and like the real Spencer and the real Warren. Mm-hmm. And real Spencer says, neither of us were serious. And real Warren says, I took it very seriously. You know, or, and the visually most evocative one of that, which I thought was just such a tremendous, like just the idea to do it and the way it was done, where they're pulling up to the gas station. They both agree it's in the cold, but one of them thinks they're at a party. One of them thinks they're in a car, but then Warren decides, well, this is how Spencer remembers it, so we're going to be in the car. And it's Warren talking to actor Warren in the car, agreeing that we'll just go with this because that's how Spencer remembers it. And it was like, God, that's such a great idea. Like, what a well put together idea.
And there's also like, I mean, there's a car chase, which is filmed really well. And you think it ends with actor Warren getting hit by a minivan. But no, there's more. Content warning for emetophobes. It's not cute, but I still laughed at it. And I hate that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it has a sense of, it also has a sense of the story, like just the story knowing itself, by which I mean that there's a certain amount of like tricksiness and meta stuff that Leighton will do, but the story is good enough a lot of the time. And he knows when to get out of the way and just let it tell him what's going to happen, which is hard to do and rare to see.
Yeah, no, incredibly deft, like in pretty much every respect.
You know what's not all that deft is the segue. Buckle up, folks. It's time for a word from one of our sponsors, Best Fiends. I love thinking and talking about true crime, obviously, but just as obviously, I could use a break from the felonies every now and again. And when I feel like I need a mental vacay, my go-to is Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game with a fun, light story that engages your brain, but it's not so taxing that you'll get frustrated. It's a casual game that anyone can play, though it's made for adults, and there is something about collecting keys and diamonds and baskets of little fluffy creatures that's really appealing right now. Best Fiends was a lifesaver for me in the before times because I could play it while waiting in line at the post office, or while the dog was carefully smelling every millimeter of a stick during walkies, but it is just as key now when I'm playing it while waiting for water to boil, or winding a bobbin on my sewing machine. Yes, it's 1800 house at my house, what of it? If you have to stop in the middle of a round or level of Best Fiends, the game remembers where you were and drops you right back in, no problem. Plus, you don't need Wi-Fi to play, so if the kids are hogging the household's entire bandwidth, Best Fiends is still good to go. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. All right, speaking of friends, let's get back into our discussion of American Animals with a clip that really reminded me of the scene in Diner where they're debating Mathis, Johnny Mathis or Frank Sinatra. And Boogie's like, Presley. This just was very charming and felt genuine and is the kind of heisty scene that I love in heist movies, that like quiet time before the big day. So here's clip 11.
Names first. Eric, Mr. Black. Spencer, Mr. Green. Mr. Yellow is me. Chaz, Mr. Pink.
Fucking really, dude?
What?
You're making me Mr. Pink?
What? What's wrong, Mr. Pink?
You know exactly what's wrong with Mr. Pink, okay? I'm sorry, can I just say how dumb this entire thing is, okay? Because in the motion picture, the whole point of the names was so that nobody knew what the others were called, so they couldn't give each other up.
Relax, okay? It's just protocol so we don't address each other by our names during the robbery. Okay? Mm-hmm. No names, Mr. Pink.
It's fucking ridiculous, man.
Didn't they all die in the end of that movie?
It was the last bit where he's like, wait, didn't they all die? Also, Chaz in both real life and on screen is the chazziest Chaz whoever chazzed, and is wearing a pink Oxford shirt. And I mean, it's probably piling on for everyone to in the scene to just be like, of course he has to be Mr. Pink, and of course he's going to make a thing about it and use the phrase motion picture. But it's just really satisfying from a character standpoint, and you feel like you're eavesdropping on something, which is fun. That's the whole like drive of these movies sometimes.
Yeah, and I won't spoil it, but there's two more jokes about just that scene and just the Mr. Pink thing. And you know, one of them is Frank, and one of them is kind of like an off topic, but it keeps paying off. But and you're right, absolutely, Chaz is totes Chaz.
Yeah. he's so chazzy. So I had one more clip, which involves, again, I had a reader be like, I just think that librarian character was terribly mistreated. But I did mark this clip initially because I felt like this is the way in which, if I were running a heist like this, it would get out of control. But I don't think the movie wants us to side against the librarian. So let me play the clip, and then Jeb, you can tell me what you think.
Signed by the. That's hurting me.
I'm sorry, just relax,
no,
all right?
I can't, I gotta
I'm here
get
for the
out.
Books.
No.
We're not here to hurt you. Just relax. So I'll be over in a second.
No,
okay?
No, I can't.
Shut the fuck up. Shut up. We're not gonna hurt you. You keep struggling, it's gonna fucking hurt more. Shut up. Oh, zip tie your legs.
Oh, God help me.
Zip tie your fucking legs right now.
I mean, I think we're supposed to get from that he is. Warren is like upset. He is touched by her wailing and is really uncomfortable. Eric, meanwhile, is completely frozen. That felt very real to me, that it's like, that's why most people aren't cut out to pull heists, because this is the shit that happens. That, and, you know, leaving the actual Autobahns in a stairwell was not great. Did you think that we were supposed to, who did you think we were supposed to side with in that scene?
I think everybody.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, the rage, you know, is, it doesn't seem to be at her. I mean, if it were at her, he would have just, you know, hit her with the butt of the taser or something. Or I mean, obviously this is like not fictional, so we can't rewrite it. But you know, what it sounds to me is like that like maximal frustration at the fact that somebody won't stop being a human being at you, and
yeah,
like I was compartmentalizing you. Why are you making this hard for me? You know, and she just won't stop moaning in pain, and like it's tripping all sorts of empathy, and he's just like screaming at his buddy, because why is this difficult? This was so perfect. You know, like, how do you make God laugh? Make a plan, right? Like, this was so perfect when I thought of it.
Yeah. Well, and also that she has this very and Dowdy way of just being like, she's in pain and she's frightened, but she's also annoyed. But she said, she's like, oh, God, like, that would also be me. That I'd be like, really, bro, like, if you're going to tase me, knock me out. God. And it's just shot like he's sort of, they're going like left to right on the screen. And there's like a big arc in the taser and her face. She's like, really? Like, she's scared, but she's also like, fuck out of here. It's well done. I really didn't think that any version of this story ever made her the butt of the joke, even when lesser people like myself would have maybe punted the name BJ Gooch around for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And ultimately, like, she has the most powerful kind of, you know, valedictory in the movie. I mean, everybody kind of says something that attempts to sum up some feelings, but, and maybe this is just being like a mediocre white guy who, you know, has a chasm in his soul that he's always trying to pour something in there to fill, and empathizing a little bit too much with these guys who are like ripe with their own potential, but don't want to work for it. And she says, you know, like they wanted a transformative experience, but they weren't willing to do the work. You know, that's like, and that's so damning. Like they're in college, like literally the whole point is to create your own transcendental experiences. Like you have an entire infrastructure and ecosystem that engenders and encourages that, but you wanted to skip the line.
Yeah.
Like at a time when like, you don't have to be accountable to anything. It's not like this was something they created to get out of their shitty jobs and a life that they were locked into on like the long, slow march to the grave. Like everything was starting and they wanted to skip to the end.
Well, and the other thing that strikes me is it so often does in like heists or frauds, or like that there's just like elaborate setup. Like there's several sequences where they're doing reconnaissance here. And you just think to yourself, like she has that line where she's like, they didn't want to do the work. And I remember thinking to myself, like, but this was a lot of work. They did it wrong.
Right.
And the motivation was maybe not great, that it's like, I want to make my mark. Like it was a very, you know, 22 years old way of being in the world. But the fact is, like, a lot of work was done. It just didn't work out. And yeah, I mean, think about that a lot when it comes to frauds in particular, or counterfeiting.
Yeah. No, I mean, it definitely feels like I'm not going to do my paper, but I am going to build like an 8-foot wide card house in my dorm room and then slowly shoot it apart with a rubber band gun over the course of 6 hours. It's like, you could have just read the fucking book, dude.
Yeah. Just do it. Just eat the frog. this was really fun to watch. I would not mind owning this. I absolutely recommend it. I thought there were a couple of, it could have been a little shorter. I thought it was a little long. There was a little, like, there's a period where they're all kind of self-destructing from anxiety about getting caught. So they all totally get caught. And that decompensating section, including some like pointedly silent shots of the actual dudes, felt a little slow. Other than that, no complaints. It's a pleasure to look at. The references to other heist properties are fantastic. And yeah, I recommend. There's some vomiting in it and Ann Dowd gets tased, but compared to the topics that we usually discuss on this podcast, it's, you know, skipping while rolling a hoop. It's nice and light. Would you recommend this one as well, I take it?
Absolutely. And I don't like movies generally where I know we're going to a dreadful conclusion, because I just like, well, just tell me what it is and I'll go. Like, why are you torturing me for 2 hours about it?
Right.
And like, I don't like the tension of somebody about to embarrass themselves and fail. I'm one of those people who like has to plug his ears and hide his face when Michael Scott gets up to do like a stupid speech in the office.
Same.
And I still like I was still really moved by this. I wound up like I'm a softie with media. Like I can't cry in real life, but if you put something on the screen that's sad, I'll just like bawl. And I was just like weeping at the end of this. And for like 20 minutes after, I was just like I was trying to make lunch and I was just thinking of bits in the movie and getting like overwhelmingly affected by it. I think it's really good.
That's fantastic. I'm glad that we climbed out of that trough that the Most Wanted section put us in. Thank you, as always, for coming back. And I recommend that you watch The Imposter, because that's a crazy story based on a New Yorker story, and it's really well done as a documentary.
Will do.
All right. You two listeners, if you haven't seen it already, that's Frederick Bourdain, The Identity Thief. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. Why not?
Happy New Year to you in jail.
I hit the wrong thing, but I'm going to leave it because it works. je suis un professionnel. Please tell listeners where else they can find you and your work.
Well, if you like relentlessly trilling piano music or soundtracks at all, you would love the films of the Hallmark Network, which my friend David Roth, a sports writer, and I break down sort of like political panel shows and sort of like sports talk shows, and mostly just like overly literate people putting too much thought into something that's supposed to be on when you're folding your laundry. But it's called Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. It's probably available on whatever service you're listening to this right now. And nothing bad ever happens in the Hallmark universe. So if you want to listen to like 75 minutes of nothing bad happening, we are your hookup.
Coming up on The Blatter Presents, Two Kelly Gang Projects Enter, One Leaves. Will it be Russell Crowe's or Heath Ledger's? Listen and find out. Plus, you'll find out why I've gotten Freddie Johnson's Bad Education stuck in my head, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blatter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blatter Presents, on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, that's bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and Blatter briefs, teehee briefs, so sign up today. Today's episode is sponsored by Feels and Best Fiends. Don't forget that Feels promo at feals.com/blotter. My guest has been Jeb Lund, who's on Twitter at Mabute. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.